officer. Have you spoken with him? Is he joining the call for the documents both in Bossie and the New York Police Department and the FBI to be opened more than a half a century after Malcolm X's assassination?
At this time, we're unaware if he would join us in that call for transparency. I know that in past conversations, Ilyasa and myself have felt assured that New York Police Department would, the city leadership in New York would do the right thing here and help Malcolm X's family finally get justice. Now, with Attorney Flint Taylor and I and our legal team, we have put the ball squarely in their court to be able to tell us if they are going to be on the right side of history 59 years later. Will they give up their records?
Well, Ben Crump, we're going to leave it there. We're going to ask you to stay for a few minutes so we can ask you about the Houston police shooting of Ebony Bouncy, an amazing story with video just revealed. And we'll post it at democracynow.org. Ben Crump, civil rights attorney, Flint Taylor, co-founder of People's Law Office of Chicago. To see all our coverage of the Malcolm X assassination, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Thrills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon State Democrats move forward a plan to punish drug possession with 6 months in jail. One in five Idaho OBGYNs have left the state since Roe was overturned. And in national news, advocates press the Biden administration for updates to the Affordable Care Act. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 22nd, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon Democrats have a new version of a bill in the state legislature to add stiffer penalties to drug possession. It could get a hearing as early as Friday. Top Democrats negotiated with state Republicans to increase the jail sentences for people caught with small amounts of drugs. For weeks, they held firm on 30 days as the maximum penalty. Now they've agreed to 6 months. The newly expected version of House Bill 4002 weakens the requirement for police officers to connect people to treatment if they've been caught with drugs. State Senator Kate Lieber and Representative Jason Kropf hope that with Republican support and buy-in from law enforcement, they can avoid a full-scale repeal effort on the ballot this November. Advocacy groups have met this change with disappointment and anger. They've urged lawmakers not to abandon the drug decriminalization started by Measure 110, passed by voters in 2020. Reporting from ProPublica last week showed that state leaders failed to make the measure work. It detailed how two governors and legislative leaders effectively sandbagged the measure, doing only what the strictest interpretation of the law required of them. Data supports the assertion by advocates that criminalization does not work to help people treat substance use disorder or even prevent overdoses. A survey of Oregonians by RTI International showed that contact with the carceral system, including even a night in jail, doubles the risk of overdose for people with substance use disorder. The new House Bill 4002 could get a hearing as soon as Friday. Well, Oregon's short legislative session is halfway over, and work continues on various bills, while some have already been effectively killed after not passing a first hurdle this past Monday. Legislation on reducing greenhouse gases won't move forward this session. Senate Bill 1559 would have raised Oregon's official goal for greenhouse gas emission reductions before 2050 from 75% up to 95%. That's the number that's recommended by the State Climate Action Commission. According to the bill's author, Senator Michael Dembrow of Portland, it was mostly symbolic and aspirational, but Republican senators were still wary and urged Democrats to move on. A legislative area that is in trouble, according to OPB, is funding for wildfire prevention. An approach put forward by Democrat Paul Evans of Monmouth sought to change the state constitution to allow for an increase in state property tax, but that received a lot of pushback and it's likely dead. Another idea put forward by Democrat Jeff Golden of Ashland is still alive, though. Senate Bill 1593 would tax owners of large tracts of forest land who benefit from prevention efforts and would raise between $75 million and $110 million annually. Voters would have to approve that change in a November ballot. Coming up this weekend, it is the McMinnville Short Film Festival on February 23rd through 25th. KBOO's Ezra has more on the story.
Heather Wilder is the executive director of the McMinnville Short Film Festival. It's been going on for 13 years and showcases over 100 films and features talks with leaders and innovators in the filmmaking industry at the McMinnville Cinema.
We represent emerging and unique and original voices in short film, and we try to celebrate them over our festival. We have multiple events that go on that are open to the public to mix in with the filmmakers. All of our films are displayed digitally, so this is a first-run theater. And we have a wonderful set of guest speakers this year. Jonathan Raymond, who works with Kelly Reichardt, Liz Cardenas, who is an up-and-coming producer, as well as multiple other people, celebrities that come down and engage in this festival that's going on.
Heather says short films are a creative medium allowing for more freedom of expression than traditional feature-length films. They can represent a calling card or be an introduction to the industry for new filmmakers.
There's a history of film where short films were kind of looked at as a starting point. And now if you look at the industry, short films are now an expression outside of the studio system to do more engaging, emerging work. It engages the audience in sort of a way that maybe isn't viewed on what you can find looking up a streaming service. It's exciting to see short films.
The festival offers more than just films. It also features talks with established figures in the film industry in hopes of forging connections for up-and-coming creators.
Our talks are industry-related for our filmmakers to be able to network, to gain knowledge, to advance their careers, and be able to do a Q&A back and forth with somebody who's actively working in the industry.
This focus on networking is how Heather got involved.
One of my short films premiered at the McMinnville Short Film Festival like 4 years ago, and I had such an incredible experience. I kind of stuck with it. I ended up volunteering for the executive director at the time, and then she ended up stepping down, and I kind of threw my hat in the ring and ended up becoming the executive director. And I'm just trying to provide the same experience that I had.
The festival focuses on diversity and inclusion with multiple categories from animation and comedy to documentary and experimental or just weird.
We have documentary and social impact films and LGBTQ films. A lot of our filmmakers are coming from multiple different backgrounds, and it's exciting to have a mixer where everybody can mingle in and hopefully future collaborate on work.
The festival is about connection and thought-provoking art. The takeaway is meant to be that whoever you are and whatever your experience, you're not alone.
You know, I think the goal of any good film festival is that they're going to sit in an audience situation and watch a film, and they're going to feel recognized and might feel like they're not isolated, that they can relate and have conversation, whether it's a kid in the audience that's LGBTQ related, whether it's Native American or a woman or whomever, that might watch something, a story on the screen and say, oh my gosh, I feel seen.
That was Heather Wilder on the McMinnville Film Festival. More information is available at their website, mcminnvillefilmfest.org. For KBOO News, I'm Ezra.
Snowpack in the western U.S. is changing, and that's a problem for water management. Millions rely on meltwater during the spring and summer. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across much of the American West, mountain snowpack acts as nature's water towers. The snow accumulates in winter, then it melts slowly, feeding lower elevation streams and rivers during the spring and summer, when rainfall in some areas is scarce.
That water from the snowpack really provides the majority of downstream water resources, and so there's really a reliance on that snowmelt.
But Kate Hale, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says that as the climate warms, snowpack and snowmelt are changing. As temperatures warm, more precipitation is falling as rain, and the snow that does accumulate often melts faster and earlier in the year, which can result in springtime flooding followed by summertime drought. In recent research, Hale developed a new way of measuring snow water storage.
With really a focus on when does precipitation, particularly snow, when does it fall and when does it melt? And how is that changing?
She says it can help water managers predict how wintertime conditions will affect water supplies later in the year and plan for how to manage limited water resources in a warmer future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
One in five OBGYNs in Idaho have left the state since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. That's according to a study by the Idaho Physician Well-Being Action Collaborative. OBGYNs are doctors of obstetrics and gynecology. They specialize in pregnancy, childbirth, and the female reproductive system. The report found that half of Idaho's 44 counties don't have a practicing obstetrician. Under Idaho code, doctors who perform abortions that are not within the strict limitations outlined by the state risk losing their license and 5 years in prison. Doctors say the restrictions are confusing, making them difficult to comply with. Caitlin Gustafson is a Valley County family care obstetrician. She told Boise State Public Radio, quote, "What we're seeing in this report and with this exodus of providers is that now Idaho is a state that criminalizes physician and the chilling effect is real," end quote. The report also shows that Idaho ranks low in maternal pregnancy outcomes, the 10th percentile. That means that 90% of the U.S. has better outcomes for pregnancy than Idaho does. Two Idaho hospital obstetrics programs closed since 2022. Now, there are only about 200 providers for some 900,000 Idaho women. Consumer advocates are urging the Biden administration to update essential health benefits first defined under the Affordable Care Act some 13 years ago. Adding dental, vision, hearing, and comprehensive reproductive services will help people get and stay healthy, but some insurers balk at the cost of expanding coverage. Eric Galatis reports in Colorado.
The number of people with Affordable Care Act health coverage is on the rise, but many are not able to access the care they need to get and stay healthy. Adam Fox with the Colorado Consumer Health Initiative says the Biden administration has an opportunity to update the ACA's essential health benefits, services that almost all individual and small employer insurance plans across the country are required to cover. He says all Americans need access to fundamental services.
Like dental, which is currently covered for children, but not adults. It should cover the full range of reproductive health services and perinatal and postpartum care for people who are giving birth, as well as hearing and vision benefits.
Colorado has made some headway expanding benefits to address healthcare needs, including gender-affirming care and coverage for all people regardless of their immigration status. Some insurers providing coverage through the ACA have warned that expanding essential benefits will drive up insurance premiums and healthcare costs in general. Fox believes updating essential benefits would actually lower costs and improve the quality of health coverage for all people, whether they get insurance through the ACA marketplaces like healthcare.gov, employer-sponsored plans, or programs like Medicaid.
The reality is many of these services are proactive and preventive care that help people maintain their health and avoid much more costly health interventions are likely to save costs.
It's been more than 13 years since the Affordable Care Act established rules defining 10 categories of health services that most insurance policies must cover. Fox notes many states have not done anything to update or expand benefits.
And what we need is federal action to update essential health benefits, ensure that the full range of whole person care is covered, and that is made a requirement across the country.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
A new report finds a shortage of mental health professionals means many Americans seeking care cannot find or afford a practitioner. Advocates say states need to change the way they provide mental health services in order to see improvements. Mark Richardson has the story.
A new report contends only 1 in 3 people with commercial health insurance and a mental health condition is able to find proper mental health care. Released by the mental health advocacy group Inseparable, the report finds significant barriers in Americans' ability to access and afford services for mental health and substance use disorders. Report co-author Dr. Benjamin Miller, a clinical psychiatrist, says one big concern is that overall, the nation continues to treat mental health as less important than other aspects of health.
We've constructed these walls and artificial barriers around care, and it's become one of the most difficult things to see when you're in a crisis where you or your loved one get the help that they need. You have to work harder to get that help. It's almost like the cruelest irony in healthcare.
Miller says the report features more than a dozen evidence-based solutions for state policymakers, and it includes scorecards to illustrate each state's progress in adopting policies that make mental health care easier to find and pay for. The study also notes a lack of follow-up care after emergency room or hospital visits, meaning a majority of those who seek help for mental health or substance use are at increased risk of relapse and readmission. Miller says many of them can't find a practitioner.
We talk a lot about our workforce because if there's no clinicians out there to do the work and we keep referring people into a system and there's just not enough people there to treat them, like we got to solve that problem too.
Report co-author Angela Kimball is chief advocacy officer at Separable. She adds the majority of health policies are made at the state level. So that's where her group is making the biggest push for change.
We're seeing in states like Illinois, legislators who are introducing really important legislation to try and address some of the barriers that are keeping them from being able to access the mental health and substance use services that they need and deserve.
For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on world events from a human interest perspective. Stick around at 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 43. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1983, notorious Broadway flop Moose Murders opens and closes in the same night at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. The quote of the day is from Broadway reviewer Clive Barnes of the New York Post, who wrote about the play, saying that it was, quote, so indescribably bad that I do not intend to waste anyone's time by describing it, end quote. Republican witness against Hunter Biden has been indicted for falsehoods. An Alabama hospital halts IVF treatments after a controversial state Supreme Court ruling, and New York activists want new district maps to empower voters of color. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's the, while he's been president, I think that is the obstruction, the cover-up, and of course the sweetheart deal.
House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan is doubling down on allegations that President Joe Biden and his son Hunter had corrupt dealings with Ukrainian energy company Burisma. This comes as former FBI informant Alexander Smirnov has been charged with lying about the Bidens and working with Russian intelligence. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin says Smirnov's indictment destroys the GOP's already weak impeachment effort.
It appears like the whole thing is not only obviously false and fraudulent, but a product of Russian disinformation and propaganda. And that's been the motor force behind this investigation for more than a year.
Meanwhile, Biden is facing growing pressure to back a ceasefire in Gaza after the U.S. vetoed another United Nations resolution calling for one. UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield says it would have sent the wrong message to Hamas.
Without the hostage releases, we know that the fighting is going to continue.
Israel says unless the hostages are released, it'll go ahead with a military offense into southern Gaza. A million Palestinian refugees are crowded into Rafah in desperate conditions. The Biden administration continues to argue against that offensive, but critics want it to be more forceful. Days after the Alabama Supreme Court ruled frozen embryos are children, the University of Alabama at Birmingham is pausing in vitro fertilization. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley, who had her son through artificial insemination, says embryos are babies.
To save sperm or to save eggs, but when you talk about an embryo, you are talking about, to me, that's a life.
New York activists are calling on the state's Independent Redistricting Commission to revise its maps, saying they dilute minority voices. Tamika D. Mallory with Until Freedom says if the new maps go through, it could let majority white communities overrule communities of color and drive down turnout across the state.
When people don't see candidates that they believe in, people that they trust, and people who they know have a real true understanding of the dynamics of their community and their needs, people do not feel motivated to go to the polls.
Following the Kansas City parade shooting, Missouri Democrats have filed long-shot legislation to return the right to limit guns to local jurisdictions. The Republican-led legislature has paused two gun bills, one of which would allow firearms on public transit and in places of worship. But State House Democratic leader Crystal Quaid accused Republicans of political games.
They keep saying that they need to pass these bills to make Missourians safer. Obviously, they know that it will not make Missourians safer.
Finally, the White House says it'll forgive $1.2 billion in student debt for more than 150,000 borrowers. Biden says it'll apply to folks who borrowed less than $12,000. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Michigan tribes are trying out a new research project using underwater cameras to monitor wildlife. They hope it will deepen our understanding of how aquatic ecosystems work. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Researchers in northern Michigan are trying out a new project that they hope will deepen our understanding of how aquatic ecosystems work. Interlochen Public Radio's Ellie Katz has more.
Starting this spring, biologists with the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians will begin submerging video cameras near reefs. Chris Hessel is a fisheries biologist with the band. He says cameras can capture snapshots of animal movement and interaction without disturbing them. The idea is to better see how underwater animals interact with their world in ways that aren't all that different from humans.
People need to utilize grocery stores, gas stations, fast food restaurants. So you have these different components within urban development where you have people who are utilizing different facilities for different needs.
He says fish and other animals also move from place to place like this, spending different amounts of time in different areas, interacting with different species. But we just don't quite understand how or why. Hessel says using video could help biologists start to crack the code. For National Native News, I'm Ellie Katz.
The Wilton Rancheria and the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office have entered an agreement to establish a framework for cooperation and collaboration related to public safety and law enforcement within the jurisdictional boundaries of the tribe. The tribe's located about 15 miles southeast of the California State Capitol in Sacramento. Wilton Rancheria Chairman Jesus Tarango says the signing of the agreement is a big day for Indian Country.
Something as a chairman, I believe that we all have our gifts that we have, and gifts of the chair are to make sure that you're having conversations with other leaders and of other agencies and whatnot. And so today I wanted us to show our state and other areas that use us as an example.
Sacramento County Sheriff Jim Cooper.
It's been a long process. We really want to work together. I think it's groundbreaking, number one, from the state capitol. So all these staffers that work here and do legislation live here in Sacramento. The tribe is based here in Sacramento. And the legislators are here 4 or 5 days a week. So I think what we can do in these gains and these building this trust and friendship will be reflected across the state of California.
One of the goals of the agreement is to better address missing and murdered indigenous people. Chairman Tarango.
The epidemic that we have in front of us is not going to get done today. It's not going to get done tomorrow. And I love the advocating of it, but we also have to make sure we're starting to do some of the work and get people out there. And I really see that the relationships between tribes and the sheriffs are the key. That's the key for us. We're not cookie cutter here in California. So every relationship between the tribe and the sheriff has to be unique. We have to show that it could be done. And I believe taking on or tackling Sacramento County, as this is where all the laws are made for our people here in this great state, why not here? And if we could really get behind the sheriff's department and the sheriff's department could get behind us, and then we could go out and show other communities, you know, maybe they could add some things to theirs to make it fit for them and work for them.
Sheriff Cooper says MMIP is an important issue, especially as women and girls go missing across the country, and to partner with tribes to work on solving cases and prevent it from happening in the future.
MMIP is big in Indian country. It's important. The relationship has not been there. We want to build up on that relationship, and that's one of the reasons. Chairman Tarango approached me and talking about it. So it's a collaboration, it's a partnership working together, and how can we make sure we address the issues of our MMIP.
The agreement was signed last week during a MMIP summit hosted by the Wilton Rancheria and the Yurok Tribe. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. Leaders from Wisconsin's 11 tribes are gathered at the state capitol in Madison for Thursday's State of the Tribes address. This year's speech is being delivered by Forest County Potawatomi Chairman James Crawford. The annual address lays out tribal priorities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
California lawmakers propose $100 billion in spending for shelters and affordable housing across the U.S. Suzanne Potter has more.
Democratic leaders in the U.S. House and Senate reintroduced the Housing for All Act, which would put about $100 billion over 10 years toward solving the crisis of people experiencing homelessness. The bill would fund federal programs to build affordable housing and provide emergency shelter. California Senator Alex Padilla, who is co-sponsoring the bill, says housing is a human right, not a privilege.
There are more than 653,000 people experiencing homelessness in the United States, including over 181,000 here in the state of California. We know that there is a shortage of 7.3 million affordable homes in the country. So the stakes are indeed high.
Opponents of the bill cite concerns about cost. On Tuesday, local, county, state, and federal leaders spoke at a Project Home Key site in Los Angeles, a program started during the pandemic that turns old motels into permanent supportive housing with wraparound services to address issues of addiction, mental health, and unemployment. Dashiki Wikrima serves as Deputy Secretary for Homelessness with the California Business Consumer Services and Housing Agency.
Home Key has funded over 15,000 homes in 250 projects across California. And these projects will serve almost 170,000 residents.
Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass notes the bill would also fund programs to keep people from being evicted.
One of the fastest growing sectors of the unhoused population are our elders, seniors, who maybe worked in retail their whole life, didn't have a 401k, didn't have a pension. Social Security really will not pay for anything in Los Angeles, and they wind up unhoused.
The proposal would also establish a commission to focus on racial equity in housing. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Leaders in Arizona are applauding the EPA's newly enacted soot standards, which they say will help mitigate serious health impacts. Alex Gonzalez has the story.
Arizona leaders are encouraged by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's new soot standards that they say will protect people from dangerous and deadly particle pollution. Sandy Barr with the Grand Canyon Chapter's Sierra Club says the revised standards will help reduce harmful pollution and improve air quality by lowering the standard for fine particulate matter that are 2.5 microns or less in diameter, known as PM2.5, from 12 micrograms per cubic meter to 9 micrograms per cubic meter.
And due to its small size, soot
penetrate our lungs, get into our bloodstream, causing really harmful impacts, including premature death, heart disease, aggravated asthma, decreased lung function, coughing, and difficulty breathing.
The EPA says the new standards will prevent up to 4,500 premature deaths and 290,000 lost workdays, yielding up to $46 billion in net health benefits in 2032. But Barr says the standard failed to strengthen the 24-hour PM 2.5 standard, which would have helped protect Arizonans from short-term spikes in air pollution. Will Humble is the executive director for the Arizona Public Health Association. He contends the new standards are what he calls a call to action for air quality districts around the state and Arizona's Department of Environmental Quality.
Come up with new plans to implement new strategies to reduce the amount of particulate matter that's coming off of agricultural lands, industry, paved roads, even fireplace dust. And smoke. So there's a lot of different sources that they're going to have to take a look at now.
Humble says the new standard will prevent air quality districts and the Department of Environmental Quality from placing their monitoring stations in areas that he says they know are clean, instead focusing on communities where people live and work. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Democrats are working to give local governments more control over firearm regulations. Missouri House Democrats have filed H.J.R. 135 in an effort to allow local and city regulators to make their own gun laws. Farah Siddiqui has more on the story.
In 2021, Governor Mike Parsons signed the Second Amendment Preservation Act, a controversial law that prevented federal law from overreaching on a person's right to bear arms. Law enforcement agencies with officers who knowingly enforce any federal laws could be sued and fined up to $50,000. Missouri House Minority Leader Crystal Quaid calls the parade shooting an example of the state's weak gun laws.
Law enforcement officers are begging and pleading with us to allow them to do their jobs. The basics of juveniles in the city being able to carry guns and cops pulling them over and not being able to take them from them. And to the speaker's comment, laws don't fix things. And what the hell are we doing as lawmakers? Why are we here at all?
Majority Republicans scrapped a bill which would have allowed concealed guns in transit and places of worship. They did, however, attempt to change Missouri's initiative petition process.